The stock market is all about things you can't predict as well as things that are regular. So I can understand why it would be relevant. In fact, I had a former Westminster student, a Westminster graduate, who worked for an investment organization. And he wrote to me after he found the book. And he was really enthusiastic about it. He said, it's the kind of thing that my colleagues and I are doing all the time with this high-powered mathematics. We're always relying on probabilities. So it was interesting reaction. And I hadn't thought of that dimension because my background is in science more than in finance.
I would say most of the statistical and probability analysis work that's done in the world is probably done in business and finance. I think there are more people running regressions on valuations and performance probably than there are people running regressions on, say, empirical data from the natural
Experiments, yeah.
sciences. A lot
Yeah,
of
and of course there's money in it, right? So that makes it worthwhile for people to invest energy in it.
Yeah, and I find myself wondering, does a Christian have an advantage in this? In other words, are your insights simply a matter of theism provides the necessary theoretical foundation of statistics, so only theists can do probability and statistics consistently. In other words, only theists can consistently use these models and have it be consistent with their worldview. Or does it go further? Does the antithesis go further such that Christians would actually do the mathematical operations differently, or use them differently?
Well, I do believe that the foundations are not simply theism, but specifically the Christian God. And I touch on that in areas where I talk about the one and the many, right? And that's all over the place because the regularity depends on many events, right? But the many events illustrate the regularity. So the two are correlative with one another, and each makes sense only in terms of the other. Well, I believe that has its origin in the one and many and the divine nature. Though obviously, I want to say there's a distinction, clear distinction between God, the Creator, and everything He's created, but He shows His character in the things that He's made.
So
So I,
so
you
a
know,
non
I would,
I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
yeah, so I would argue that it's not a bare theism, but actually Christian theism that explains that. But your other question is about
Let me stop you before we get to the other question. On this first question. So if I think I'm understanding you properly, you're saying unless you have some sense of plurality, if unless you have, say, for instance, a triune understanding of God, you will have trouble not collapsing into monism in your philosophy, and therefore, and monism is a pretty lousy foundation for mathematics because in the end, it comes down to 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 = 1.
One. Yeah, it's all, you never get
You never get beyond one, right?
beyond
Okay. All right, I got that. Very good point. So that having been said, whether it's theism or specifically Christian or triune theism, would someone who's practicing from that worldview practice differently? Would they do different equations? I'm sorry, go ahead.
And that's your second question. I think it's a excellent question. And you may know I have another book on Redeeming Mathematics is the title, where I discuss the fact that there can actually be differences at a high level in mathematics, that not everybody accepts the same mathematical truths. But that is a kind of subtle thing. And I think at the level we're talking about with most use of probability and statistics, what we're seeing is that everybody secretly relies on God, even the atheist does. And I've got another book, Redeeming Science, whose introductory chapter is about that. But actually, there's one chapter in the book on chance. Let's see if I can single it out. It's chapter 11 on the Trinitarian Foundations of Chance. No, wait a minute. It's later on. Yeah, chapter 17 is where
Theistic
I
Foundations
through,
for Probability.
Yeah. Where I go through that various attributes of God are manifested in the regularities involved in probability. So everybody depends on that.
So there has to be unity, but there also has to be diversity.
Yeah.
And there also and symmetry. In other words, you throw a die, 1/6 probability is in symmetry, of getting a 1 is in symmetry with a 1/6 probability of getting 2, which is in symmetry with a 1/6 probability, et cetera, et cetera. So you have unity, diversity, symmetry.
Yes.
I'm sorry, is there something you want to say about that?
Well, not especially, except I'm saying everybody really secretly relies on God, but they won't admit it. And what happens is that the regularities, the lawful regularities of the entirety of probability theory and the entirety of its application in various realms in life, depends on these lawful regularities. They're there, but the person who doesn't believe in God, says he doesn't believe in God, he still relies on those, but he thinks of those regularities as impersonal. Hmm. So they're just there. They're kind of cosmic mechanism. And, I argue that that really doesn't work because the features of the regularities include a personal aspect. So everybody.
For example, what do you mean the features of the regularity include personal aspects?
Yeah, well, let's take the very simple one of that the heads will come up half the time, right? Well, that's already a statement about regularity.
Yes.
It's a general statement. And it's rational. And it's language-like. And those two features, rationality and language-like, are characteristic only of persons. What I think people often don't recognize is they think of the world, because of the influence of materialistic philosophy, they think of the world as matter in motion. Or even if they're dealing with human society, it's regularities that have no further explanation other than they're just there. But if you look at the character of what we expect the regularities to be, we expect them to be always the case. That's the feature of eternality, everywhere the case. That's the feature of everywhere present. It's characteristics of God.
Eternal, so ubiquitous.
Everybody relies
all powerful.
On that.
There's no force in the universe that can turn 2 + 2 into something other than 4.
Something else, that's right. Yeah. So everybody relies on that, and it's actually revelatory of God. It's divine nature. It's divine. It's characteristics of God that are being revealed there, and that people are relying on. But the classic way of getting around it is to think of these lawful things as impersonal, because then you're not responsible morally to them. They're just there, and if they're mechanical, they're basically inferior to you as a person rather than being God ruling the universe.
No one has to give an account to the laws of science or mathematics.
That's right. So there is a spiritual motivation for for not admitting that these regularities are of a personal character, that it's God speaking personally and specifying everything about the world, and he's faithful to himself, which is why there is consistency. We can, and people rely on it so much they think of it just as a mechanism, but it's God's faithfulness. So I'm reinterpreting the entire world as in terms of the meaning that it has when you realize that God governs it. But it's not a reinterpretation in a vacuum, as if I'm just saying, well, let's see what we could say if we assume that God is there. But that actually, that is the character of these regularities. They have the attributes of God, including language like character and personality, which show, or language like and rationality, those two things reveal that they're personal.
So you're not you're not running that worldview as a hypothesis. You are taking that worldview as the only sure foundation for the very idea of hypothesis and hypothesis
testing.
Yeah,
that's right. You used the word presupposition. It caught my ear, and it suggests to me that you're really informed because yeah, I'm from the school of what's called presuppositional apologetics. Does that mean something to you?
It started to mean something to me when I was converted to Christianity when I was 19 years old by reading Cornelius Van Til.
Okay.
Before that, it didn't mean anything to me, but...
Yeah, I see. Well, yeah, but you see, I was in Van Til's classes the first year I was in seminary in 1971.
I was, so. as a teenager, I was sort of a searcher, first an atheist. I started reading Marx and Frome and Marcuse and that crowd, sort of socialist
right.
atheists in my early teens. By around 17 or 18, I was starting to incline towards Christianity and was reading Aquinas and C.S. Lewis,
yeah.
but I didn't find them to be definitive. I didn't find
yeah.
them to be deal closers. And
right.
I met a Presbyterian minister. I graduated from high school and I took a year off between high school and college. I met a Presbyterian minister who sensed that I was looking for more, and he started tossing books at me. And a lot of it was Van Til. And in Van Til,
right.
I found the sure foundation that I had not gotten from Lewis
right.
or Aquinas or various others. So then
right.
went on to read
right.
Dooyeweerd and some of the others and
yes,
Piper.
I see. Well, for somebody who writes for Forbes, I wasn't expecting.
I don't think you're going to find any other Van Tilians writing at Forbes.
Yeah. But that means that there's a lot that I don't have to explain as much, because it can. What I'm doing can seem very strange, but it's just saying the world that God made is God's world, and everybody's living it and in it, and they can't evade the fact that it's constantly testifying to who God is, and that includes the areas of chance and probability. And I think there's something in the book, but what happened is I wrote this earlier book, Redeeming Science. I have a background in science. And then I realized after I wrote it, that was 2006, that I'd focused on the laws, the regularities, but not on the unpredictabilities. And I realized, you know, I really ought to go after that, because in some respects it's even more challenging, because people think of that part as being under the rule of chance, capital C. You know,
yes.
So it becomes a substitute God.
So then you have almost like a Kantian split
yeah,
between
yeah.
the rules of science, which are perfectly rational and never change, and then some zone outside of that, which is chaotic and
yeah.
irrational. And you get a dualism between kind of control law on one side and chaos chance on the other
right.
side.
Yeah, yeah. But at the same time, paradoxically, chance functions as a kind of alternate explanation. So once we've said, well, that's due to chance, then that's your explanation, and you don't have to bring God into the picture. You know,
all right,
that's
so
how the world thinks.
When we say something is due to chance, are we offering it as an alternate hypothesis to the idea of law, or are we offering it as an alternate hypothesis to the idea of design, plan, and providence?
Yeah, well, that's the crucial question, because although I polarize it in terms of our ignorance, you know, so we can say it was chance because there's no explanation in terms of law that I can give. But of course, God brings these things about. And so they're not, and they're designed as well. But I think the way I would go, I mean, I'm
so nothing's chance. So nothing's chance to him. I think that's what I'm hearing you're saying. I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, there's nothing that's chance in an absolute sense. There are things that happen that we cannot predict because of our limited knowledge. So
right.
It's the creator-creature distinction. We are limited, and it's also the fact that God, I believe, you know, I'm with Van Til, I'm Reformed Calvinist. I believe that God has ordained the details, not just the generalities about the history of the world. And that means that he specifies in his source, his language, think of it as his governing word specifying every detail of every event. Mm-hmm. So the language specifies not only the regularities, but the unpredictabilities. And so we can say the unpredictable things are kind of one-time law, right, where God says, let this coin come up heads this one time. And that's the law governing that particular coin flip. So you can use the law in that sense, but typically that's not the way we think of it. We think of it in terms of laws or things about a generality.
So if you looked at it from that standpoint, if I flip a coin, let's say it's a fair coin, there actually is not a 50% chance that it will come up heads. There's a 100% chance that it will come up in accordance with God's plan, but
yeah.
I don't know what that is.
Yeah, we don't know.
So the 50% is almost more a description of my level of knowledge about the event than it is something inherent to the event itself.
Yeah, it is. But then we have this thing of the law of large numbers kind of thing, that if you do the thing, if you flip the coin 1,000 times, it will come out roughly 500 heads.
Yes.
And that's saying it's not just the lawfulness is not just the individual flip, but it's over time. It's over repeated instances. So there is something about this 50% that corresponds to the way that actually God governs the world.
So I suppose then there are laws that govern our ignorance in some sense.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Right, that God knows everything. We know a small subset of that. There are things we don't know, but there's an order to reality, an order to creation such that we can apply certain laws even to the things we don't know, which over time will tend to occur.
That's right. And God himself knows how it looks from each individual human point of view with our limited knowledge. Though he's not confined to that, he understands what each individual human point of view.
I think Leibniz says that the human analog of God's omniscience is, you know, millions of people with different points of view. That's the kind of created analog of that. Is that what you're
right.
saying? Yeah.
Sort of, except I want to underline that God knows each of those points of view so that they're combined in a rational way rather than just being so many points of light with no unity.
I see. So he doesn't know them just as individuals. He knows them as part of an overall plan and coherence in the
Yeah,
creation.
right.
You mentioned that you have a science background. I think I read on the back of Chance and the Sovereignty of God that you have 6 degrees. Is that correct?
Yes.
What are they?
Okay, well, do them in chronological order. It's a BS in mathematics from Caltech. And that's where, if I had been forbidden to major in mathematics, I would have majored in physics. I delighted in the science, but the mathematics was, the strongest thing. And then I did a PhD in mathematics at Harvard University. Taught mathematics for a year, then came to Westminster Seminary as a student,
Where
where
did
I
you where did
got
you where did you teach mathematics?
at Fresno State College,
Okay.
the Bulldogs.
Got
I still root for them.
it.
So, but that was where my father taught Spanish, so I grew up in that area. It was a natural.
Got it.
But then I went to Westminster Seminary as a student, got a Master of Divinity, which is you undoubtedly know it's the standard degree for pastors, but it's become more broad for it's a sort of core theological education, and then a Master of Theology in apologetics. So I did have that apologetic streak in me. Then I went to University of Cambridge in New Testament and ended with an MLit, Master of Literature, which is their version of an MA, essentially. And then a PhD, which is essentially, well, it's Doctor of Theology, but it's like a PhD, except with another name. A PhD from the University of Stellenbosch in Stellenbosch, South Africa.
And was that, did that have a focus in
New Testament.
philosophy or Apollo? Oh, New Testament.
New
Okay.
Testament.
And what do you,
And
go ahead.
I'm teaching New Testament in the New Testament department. That's how I'm listed at Westminster Seminary.
Do you teach anything else? Do you teach apologetics or anything of that
On
nature? I see.
occasion. I've taught a course on the theology of science a number of times, for example, and just this last semester, fall semester, I taught one on theology of language, and it was oriented towards apologetics. So I've had that interest, and we're a friendly group at Westminster, so even though it crosses over departments, people are not troubled.
Have you thought about teaching the things that you write these books about? I get the impression that you're kind of rewriting the science, the basically the human knowledge curriculum, from the
Yeah.
standpoint of Christian Trinitarian theism. I mean, you've got something on
That's right.
sociology. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, if you know about Van Til, Van Til was inspired and influenced by Abraham Kuyper in the Netherlands. And Kuyper had this vision, Christ is Lord of all of life. And so we ought to look in a different way at every academic discipline and every other element, business, work, family, everything should be, it was influenced by a distinctive Christian approach. So Kuyper did that, and you mentioned Dooyeweerd. The Dooyeweerd was this kind of a neo-Kuyperian. They were in a later generation and were inspired by him. There's good and bad in them. I respect what they were trying to do, but I think they made some mistakes at an early point of view. So, I'm trying to do at least pieces of the same thing in order to encourage other people to do it. And one of these years, I had a student with a background in computer science in one of these courses in theology of science. So I said, why don't you consider writing something on the theistic foundations of computer science and information? And he did, and it's now become a booklet. So it's that kind of thing that I want to encourage, not just, pay attention to what I write, but take it in other directions as well.
Well, you're taking Van Til to the next level, incarnating
Yes.
the ideas in the theoretical subdisciplines that you're familiar with, and you're encouraging other people to fill in the ones you don't know.
Yes.
Oh, I see. Okay. You know, I note that in Augustine's biography, when he converted, the project that he wanted to do was to rewrite the seven liberal arts, essentially, on a Christian foundation.
Right.
So he wrote this little Enchiridion, this little short introduction. I think he managed to churn out De Musica, you know, of music.
Yeah.
And then from then on, he never got back to it. You know, people would come to him and they'd ask him questions as a pastor, and he'd have to write about this topic or that topic because there was a pastoral need for it. And he never got to come back to his original project of rewriting the curriculum in accordance with his new faith. And it's almost like you're picking that up where he left
yes.
off.
Yeah, I think that's what I want to do. All right.
Okay. Well,
and Van Til wrote a whole book on Christian education. So he was very interested in that element.
But he couldn't do it all in his generation.
No, he couldn't. Yeah, and because science is so has such an overwhelming influence nowadays, that was the first one that I did. I thought, you know, there's a need here, and I think I can say some things that are not being said already. You know, there's endless debates about days of creation and about Darwinian evolution, and there's good and there's bad things out there. So I didn't want to just repeat that, but I wanted to give a vision for, here's a Christian view of science. And likewise, then, you know, because I focused on the lawfulness, here's a Christian view of chance.
So let's come back to that. It occurs to me that the work you're doing here, you're in essence saying that chance is a feature of our ignorance, not a feature of the universe in and of itself. Are not a feature of creation in and of itself. That
yes.
from God's standpoint, yes. nothing is left to chance.
Right.
From our standpoint, lots of things are left up to chance, but that's not because of what they are in themselves. It's essentially our limited knowledge of them. So you have
yes.
the laws of probability, which in essence are a set of laws that we use to analyze our ignorance in some sense. To,
yes.
Right?
Go ahead. There's where this thing of there's actually a lawfulness to the ignorance.
Yes.
You know, that's something that that atheists, it doesn't trouble them generally, but it should. You know, pure chance, there can't be anything, any laws left. You know, you're talking about chaos. There's even one guy, and again, I'm going back to the science because that's where I came from years ago. There's a Nobel laureate in physics, Eugene Wigner.
Oh, yes. Unreasonable effectiveness in mathematics and the natural sciences, right?
Yeah, he wrote this article where he kind of stood back from the detailed work that he'd done in physics and asked, why is this possible? And the article is entitled something like The Unreasonable
Effectiveness
of Mathematics in the Physical Sciences.
Yes.
And he says, why should this be? And he says, we have no explanation. Well, I have an explanation. Because God brings coherence between the math and the world.
Because the same mind that created our mind created the world. The world
yes.
runs on the same software as our mind, namely the Logos.
Yes, exactly.
Wigner's not mentioned in Chance and the Sovereignty of God. I just looked in your index. I guess that's more relevant to the science.
It is, because he's dealing with the why are there laws, you know.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I now that you pointed out, maybe I should have included it, because there is this lawful regularity aspect in probability as well, but I didn't do it, and it's too late to do it.
Well, I remember reading something in Van Til way back there in my late 20s or late teens and early 20s, where he said something to the effect of, if there is a zone of complete randomness anywhere in the universe, then the universe itself must be assumed to be completely random, because if there's anything fully random, then it can eat up everything. If you've got a zone, if you've got a nanometer of complete total randomness, you know, someplace in the universe, and it's completely and totally random and not governed by anything, then what law stops it from gobbling up the rest of the universe?
Yeah, right, because it'll interact with everything else, and so eventually you won't be able to predict anything.
Right, so you're forced into complete randomness, and then you have no laws of mathematics at all, except as human conventions.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, so what do you have you done any thinking about Gödel and the incompleteness theorem and how that kind of fits together with what you're doing? Because a number of... Go ahead. Okay, tell me your thoughts, please.
Well, there's a book. There's another book. It's called Logic, the God-Centered Approach to the Foundation of Western Thought. And I discuss Gödel's proof, even though it's related to arithmetic, it's really a logical thing more so. So I discuss it in that book. And I think it's related to the relationship between human finiteness and our ability to transcend any particular vision by adding one more to it or going to another level. And Gödel's proof works that way. But I discuss it in detail in the Logic book. And I do think it's related. It's a revelation of, again, both the finiteness of human thought and our ability to think God's thoughts after him.
Yes, and the finitude issue, it seems to me, kind of plays into what you're doing. If a human mind can't create the foundations for a mathematical discipline that are provable, then they're either simply chosen irrationally, or they have to be provided from something outside the system, a transcendent mind.
Yeah.
And I think that Berlinski, are you familiar with David Berlinski and his work at all?
I am. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I haven't read his book on math, but he's he's a very interesting, provocative guy.
And we talked, in a previous interview, we discussed his view of Gödel. And he viewed Gödel's incompleteness theorem as tending to support theism. That in essence, by showing the limits of human knowledge in creating mathematical systems, and the point that Berlinski made is, look, if modern mathematics cannot even use formal logical principles to prove the integers, who's Bertrand Russell failed, is largely considered to have failed. So you basically, what Berlinski says is, you're back to what Loniker said: God created the integers. That they have to be givens from a higher mind, that we can't prove them from within a human logic.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. So you've looked at Gödel. Have you looked at information theory and how that fits? Because information theory is almost like a second generation of Prabhan stats, and it's something that's really getting a lot of attention from the intelligent design school. From Dembski and my friend George Gilder, etc. Have you looked at that? How does all that fit together with what you're doing?
A little bit. Information theory is built on top of underlying probability theory. So what I'm saying will carry over in that respect. But to the degree that I've gotten into it, it's actually been more from the standpoint of language than just the standpoint of probability, because information theory, you're dealing not with just with probabilities, but with communication issues.
Hmm.
Now, modern information theory started with Shannon and who else was it?
There's Turing?
Guy.
Shannon?
He was at... after
von Neumann.
They were interested in looking at basic aspects of transmitting digital information over channel, and that what they defined as information was very one-dimensional, which means that you can make it more rigorous. But the fact is, it's language reduced to one small aspect, but it coheres actually with our experience of natural human languages. And I wrote a couple of articles about that, which appeared in Semiotica. It's a journal of sign systems. Semiotics is about sign systems.
Hmm.
Not only natural language, but Morse code, for instance, is a semiotic system. So I have written a couple, but it's no more than articles. Now, you probably know I've got a website that I share with John Frame, frame-poitras.org, that has, it has these two articles if you want to look at them.
I will look them up. I didn't notice them on the websites. I'm reading Frame's History of Western Thought right now.
Good for you. And that's a great book.
And enjoying it. I suppose info theory has there's signal, but signal isn't the same thing as meaning. So it's kind
yeah,
of...
Yeah, that's the thing. That's what I mean by one-dimensional.
Yeah.
If you've got a random sequence of zeros and ones and you transmit it over a channel, then that's information. But if it's random, it doesn't mean anything.
Right, exactly. So noise in this situation, noise is what's regular and predictable, right? So noise is low entropy. So in information theory, an actual message is high entropy, but randomness, a random string, is also high entropy. Information theory can't distinguish between complete nonsense and the most profound sentences ever written, because they're both high entropy.
Yeah.
You need a mind receiving on the other end to say, wait, you know, now that this has been decoded, does it have meaning?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So what's next? You're rewriting sort of the curriculum for sociology and linguistics and mathematics and probability theory. What's next on the agenda?
Yeah, well, I had this one on redeeming philosophy.
Oh, philosophy.
That's already out.
And logic.
But there's one coming that's Christ, the Lord of all of life. It's basically restating the Kuyperian vision of Christian faith interpreting in its own distinctive way every area, and not only interpreting, that would be the more educational thing, but then acting, you know, living out the Christian faith in every area.
All right,
so I'm restating that for another generation.
Let's talk about living out, because having read Chance and the Sovereignty of God twice, and I'm just starting Redeeming Mathematics, I've read some of the logic book, I find myself with coming out of it with essentially one commandment, which is think differently, but I'm not getting any commandment that says live differently. That in other words, that Van Til is about what is the proper theoretical foundation of knowledge, right? He gets that from Kuiper. Kuiper got it from, I guess, Vollenhoven. Is that right? Is he sort of the beginning of that?
Well, it's the other way. Vollenhoven is later than Kuiper.
Oh, okay. Kuiper then Vollenhoven. Got it. Thank you. I'm not as up on my Reformed philosophers, Dutch Reformed philosophers. But I'm not seeing, I'm a practitioner in mathematics. I mean, I'm not a full-time Forbes guy. This is a hobby for me. I do economic, I'm an economist, and I do financial analysis. I work with statistics all the time. I didn't come out of this book at the end and saying, okay, now I'm going to do my, I'm going to stop using R-squares or start using R-squares, or I'm going to stop using p-values. I didn't, surely if this is transformative, we'd act differently.
Yes. Well, you're right, and the action is in a sense even more important than the thinking. You know, James chapter 1 talks about people who listen to the message and never act on it. And so you're right. Christianity is life of obedience to Christ and not simply mental transformation.
He who does the will of my Father shall know my doctrine. Not the other way around. Not he who knows my doctrine shall... I'm sorry, go ahead. I interrupted you.
Yeah. So So I agree with that, but then the way in which you're asking is it how is it going to influence things at a technical level? And because my understanding of lawful regularity as ordained by God, it's next door to the non-Christian's understanding because he's secretly depending on God. So there can be areas where it doesn't look a lot different in superficial ways. But I would say the difference is partly the mental one of we now accept what we're doing in different contexts. But then it is also spilling over into larger vistas of life because let me talk about it in terms of sociology, where I've thought about it. Sociology is dominated by what you might call the vision of scientific sociology, where we're going to do statistics and questionnaires, and we're going to analyze causal relationships and social tendencies by seeing correlations between statistics. So it's heavily influenced by mathematics. But what's happening is your vision of human nature is being reduced to what is quantifiable. And if you are a Christian, you see God governs that. We're not denying its significance or its importance or your ability to do really neat analyses on that level, but it's not the whole. And if I may talk about, I'm going out into my area of ignorance, but the things about the stock market, people who are modeling it, some of them are economists. They talk about the ideal rational agent.
Yes.
Well, there's no such thing.
Right.
All right? It is a simplification. Now, it's a convenient simplification, but you've got to keep telling yourself this is a simplification, and it's going to some in some cases leave out things that are really, really significant. So I guess now, people are onto the fact that when the market goes down, I just saw something fairly recently where they said that the stock market as a whole tends to inch up, and it's gradually growing,
And then
and
crashes.
then it will be a correction, and the correction will be very rapid. We had a minor correction just at, this first few days of January.
Right. Well, as
And
I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
it's because people panic, But yeah, my point is that they at least. I mean, now people are always trying to get more sophisticated in their modeling, but the point is, the real people are always more complicated than that. And I fear that in our whole, I mean, this is a bigger issue, that our whole capitalist system is driven too exclusively by economic issues. And I like capitalism because I think it's better than its alternatives.
What do you mean it's too
But
driven by economic issues?
it can drive everything else. And then you have, for instance, owners of businesses are only thinking in terms of making money, not in terms of serving their customers, not in terms of serving their employees,
I
but
see.
creating a decent work environment. And actually, some of these things help the business economically,
Right.
If you have a good work environment, your employees are more motivated, they're not going to quit as often, all those things. But you should do it not simply because it's good for your bottom line, but because you're somebody who respects other people.
So the profit motive should not override the ethical code. So cheating or exploiting your way to profit is still cheating and exploiting, even if it's the profitability doesn't. I'm sorry, go ahead.
But what I'm saying is, when you come down to these mathematical models in
You'll
economics,
never capture that.
you're not going to capture that, and you're not going to capture the real people that really are behind the economic dynamics.
Well,
So
this kind of fits in with your thought in general, because You're an advocate of, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I see in your writing an advocacy of cosmic personalism.
Oh,
That
yeah.
behind everything is not just a person, three persons.
Yeah,
Three
yeah.
persons and one person.
Right.
So everything's personal, even
Yep.
things that don't seem to be personal. Whereas the alternative view, scientism, let's call it, eventually makes impersonalism the lord of everything. And that's where you get social Darwinism, the idea that, hey, it's good, we should let people starve because that's how human evolution takes place. The impersonal forces of natural selection should govern every aspect of life, including our social life. So we shouldn't stop the starving from starving. You get Keynesian economics from that, where some people come along. There's kind of two sides to that. There's one side that says, look, chaos rules the world. It's worked for the first 6 billion years of planet Earth. So let's keep going and let's let all those people starve because that's natural selection. Then you've got another camp, Keynes and his crew, who come along and say, no, because we've ruined natural selection in the modern world, because we don't let people starve. Man must now become the new planner, the new guider
Right.
of human evolution. And so that's the central planning idea that you see in Keynesian economics and eugenics and the central planning
Yeah.
state. But both are kind of twins of cosmic impersonalism.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's a very, very basic. And those, in the Western world, those two, no, there are few people who are consistent, right? Particularly on the impersonal side, because you can't live there. But you're right that those are really heavy driving forces. And Dooyeweerd saw this. I'm not a Dooyeweerdian, but he talked about the science ideal and the personality ideal, or
Yes.
the freedom,
Form and
let's see,
freedom,
with nature
or
and
law and
freedom.
nature freedom. That's right, yes.
And what that is even the people, I mean, some of the atheists, new atheism, they're into scientism where the only thing that counts is nature, but they can't explain their own minds. And people rebel against that into the Romantic movement was one big rebellion against the suppression of the multifaceted human personality, but it rebelled by saying we're going to express our autonomous intuitions and feelings and stuff. And we're getting some of that with postmodernism, that the people who can't take pure materialism, then they have to create meaning because they're not going to get it from outside,
There's no
right? The
meaning from
world is
outside, so you
meaningless.
have to make it,
Yeah.
right? But of course,
Yeah,
but created meaning isn't really meaning, is it? It's impulse, it's
yeah.
meaning by its nature has to have an outside standard. That's what meaning is. How does this particular piece of information fit with the outside standard?
Yeah.
You can't make meaning. By its very definition, meaning it cannot be made by well, anyway, do you understand what I'm driving at?
Yeah,
Right, that
very much.
if I get a piece of information, I have to compare it to the code book to see if it means anything. If I can't, my reaction to it can't be its meaning. Otherwise, meaning has no meaning at all. You react to everything, therefore everything means everything, or you actually have objective meaning. I'm sorry, I think I interrupted a train of thought from you, though. Okay.
No, I think you're really putting your finger on a very deep problem with modern living that is attempting to be independent of God, that you end up with a cosmic impersonalism, and that means that people can't live without meaning, so they create it, but they know all the time because they think they are creating it. They aren't creating it de novo, but if they think they are, then ultimately it's meaningless. It's just projection arbitrarily out of your self.
Let's bring that back to mathematics, since that's what this interview is at least ostensibly about, your book, Chance and the Sovereignty of God, so probability theory. I wonder if this scientism ideal, hasn't brought certain reductionisms into statistical and probability theory. I'm thinking particularly about sort of the birth of the p-value. This is something that I just interviewed Stephen Ziliak about, and there's this sort of revival in a revival in the debate between Gossett and Fisher at the very beginnings of statistical theory. And Gossett was sort of at least some sense, conservative. He was an entrepreneur. He was a capitalist. He raised his children in the church. I don't know what his particular worldview was. Fisher, on the other hand, was the aggressive atheist, the better academic politician. And Gossett, you know, after Fisher sort of adopted Gossett's idea, Gossett spent the rest of his life trying to get Fisher to stop trying to reduce everything down to some kind of alleged uncertainty that comes from the p-value. But Fisher seemed to have a need to have some kind of Archimedean point, to use a term of art, in statistics, because he had this chance probabilistic worldview that needed to be something certain in the world. So my p-value will be certain. And on that, I will build the foundation of a post-Christian, post-Victorian, atheistic, eugenics-oriented Darwinian science. And so I'm wondering, in terms of practice, I'm wondering if that's a reductionism that came in partly because of the distortion in the worldview, and whether there are other places where we're all running around doing math and we are somehow held captive to these reductionisms that occurred for philosophical reasons. We think we're doing neutral math, but in fact we're doing anything but neutral math. Your thoughts?
Yes. Well, it's good, because the mathematical models, by God's own providential control, they do model the world, although there's not an identity. And so they're useful. But at the same time, if people are captive ideologically to them, then they think this is the essence of it, and they, you know, personality and human meaning evaporates out of it. So it's something where I want to say both a yes and a no, right? Because I enjoy the mathematics, and I enjoy the application of the mathematics to the world, but with the caution, the models are always limited.
Yes, and perhaps as we suppress the truth in unrighteousness, we introduce distortions into our modeling that are not just problems at the theoretical foundation, but problems in practice. That's what I'm throwing out for you to think about.
Yeah, I think that's right, but it's a matter of, you know, continuing to look at what people are assuming and what they're presupposing. But the whole area of probability theory, as you know, one of the things that I get into in the book is the foundations of probability are disputed. And the people who are philosophers looking at that, either probability comes out of the world or it comes out of the mind. It has a logical basis. Or it comes out of subjective knowledge and the limitations of that knowledge. But those are actually three things that belong together, because God has ordained all three. Hmm. And if you don't have a God who is uniting them, then you get these tensions where you want to you force everything into a small box.
That's frames. That's a John Frame thing, isn't it? A kind of a triangle.
That triangle is it's three perspectives on ethics, but it actually applies to the foundations of probability.
And those three perspectives are there's a sort of an objective one, right?
Yeah. Well, there's a normative perspective.
Normative.
And for ethics, that's things like the Ten Commandments.
Right.
But for probability theory, it's the logic.
I see.
That underlies the theory.
And there's a subjective
one. Then there's a situational perspective for ethics that's looking at the situation and asking what will promote the glory of God. And for probability, it's looking at compiling statistics about coin flips. It's about gathering data out of the world. But why should the data have any unity? You know, we've been through this when we talked about chaos versus law, right?
Right.
If there's complete chaos, then you can't even produce a theory of it.
Well, yeah, if your approach to statistics is merely statistical, probability is merely statistical, if you're a hyper-frequentist, you don't really know if there's a tendency for the coin to come up 50%, because not all the coins in the universe have been flipped yet.
Yeah,
You have to
right.
do
Yeah,
them all. Yeah, right.
you're pure empirical, and that was Hume's problem too. How can you justify induction? And the
Right, if you
fact
start with
is,
just normative, then you've got all this sort of formalism, and you don't actually try to apply it in the real world.
yeah.
So, or subjectivism, that in that sort of self-refuting, it's just your feelings, your estimates. But you bring them all together. You have a set of rules that are kind of that are we believe from the mind of God, but nothing's chance to him. So chance is really partly a attribute of our lack of knowledge. So that brings in this that brings in the subjective element.
It does.
Yeah, all right. And then we take that out to the real world and we test and learn it in the real world. And that's the
The
situational.
situation.
Yeah, I see. Very
That's
interesting.
right. Yeah. So all three things have to be present for probability and statistics, even to make sense. You can't talk about probabilities unless you have a world, unless you have people who are looking at the world with limited knowledge, and unless you have some kind of lawfulness.
Well, okay, so let's take that those three nodes. That's helpful. So as I look at modern debates about statistics and probability, I see a Bayesian camp, a rebel alliance, that you could sort of associate with the subjective approach,
Yeah.
right? And then you've got the Fisherian stuff, which is these are the rules. Like a pure Fisherian, which is these are the rules. I've deduced them. They're absolutely reliable. I will know, perfectly if I follow these rules perfectly. And then you have a situational out there that's more like a sort of a new frequentist, which says, no, I'm actually you got it. It's all in the observation. Statistics is only an observational science. In other words, do we have a debate within probability and statistics in which each of these camps takes up one of these points of view and reduces everything to that.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly what's happening. And that it is reduction, and it's reduction, just as Frame observed in ethics, it's reduction because without God, you have to have something ultimate. You have to find an ultimate starting point within creation. Right? So you make one of these a starting point for everything else, but it doesn't really work because even at the start, those things are unintelligibly apart from their relationship to the other two.
Yes, I see. And what I see happening at the situational level is an academic world gone w crazy, where you have professors with grad students just running regressions all day long till they find something that fits, and that has a low p value. Then they can publish that in an academic journal, and publish or perish, right? And it's there's not really any hard thinking about it. There's not really any.
No.
There's not a lot of logic going on. They're almost like data mills that are filling up
Right.
these academic journals, and it doesn't even have to make sense. We've left normative and subjective out. Now it's just
Yeah.
mass regressions, and out of the chaos somehow will come, if not meaning, at least tenure.
Yep. Yeah, that's a brutal way of saying it, but yes.
I don't mean to be brutal, but as I guess as a non-academic, it sounds from my standpoint, it's
To an academic, it sounds it's deflating, let's say
I see.
that.
And then we have a crisis of replication, right? That you're torturing the data, and then so many famous studies now have been found have erroneous conclusions because the p-value is misused, or because you can't replicate the data, because it's just a matter of churning through data, just until you find something that's you can put up on the bulletin board. And I suppose if you leave behind the idea of truth, then what's left except mass churning of statistics in order to build status or power?
Yeah, and the I'm not an expert in the statistics, but I can see whatever p-value you choose, if you choose enough cases at random, you will finally find one that meets that p-value,
Yes.
but and it may have no significance at all because you've just kept churning until you find one, and that's the nature of the thing is, if your p-value is, let's say, 0.5%, then every
well, one out of 20 times you're going to get a good p-value, right? So you just run the studies enough and suppress the ones that didn't give you the right p-value. I mean, look, if you stare at the sky for enough afternoons in a row, eventually you're going to find a cloud that looks like a bunny rabbit. Mm-hmm. It's not really a bunny rabbit, but it's going to look like one. So, all right. So let's kind of bring this together a little bit, if you don't mind, with your day job, which is you're a professor of New Testament, and you do exegesis, the explication of the meaning of the text. I've been working on an exegetical project for the past few years. It's not important for our discussion what it is. But I found myself wondering and seeing if maybe probability and statistical theory might not have exegetical implications, whether it could be a tool. I'm thinking, well, let me just lay it there. In other words, there are patterns in the scripture. There's, for instance, word usage comes to mind. A writer, an Old Testament or a New Testament writer, has to decide which Koine Greek word to use or which classical Hebrew word to use. They have 10 words that they could, there might be 10 synonyms for something. So all of the things being equal, if they don't intend some particular set of connotations, there's a 1 in 10 probability that they'll use the word, you know, one of those particular words because of your principle of symmetry. But I really wonder whether your work on mathematics doesn't also have implications for your day job, in that probability and statistics provide tools to make us better exegetes. Have you thought of that, and or does that seem plausible to you?
Yeah, I have thought about it a little bit, and I think it's limited. People do appeal to statistics in making exegetical decisions, as saying this is the main meaning. For instance, 90% of the time the word has this meaning, so the default when you come to a new verse is that's probably a meaning here.
So that's a Bayesian approach almost, right? That's
it's often because the people involved are not statisticians, they won't give precise percentages, but they'll appeal at least to, you know, general impressions of this is more common than that. But it's easily becomes a fallacy, because in biblical interpretation and in human communication generally, context is king.
Yes.
So something that is actually a rare meaning, if it's evoked by context, that's it.
Yes.
And it's evident to the average reader who is familiar with, who's a native speaker of, let's say, Koine Greek. Now, we don't have any around now, but the person who's a native speaker recognizes right away. And I have sometimes talked in class about a certain exegetical principle, that what is probable is certain, which sounds paradoxical until I explain it. And it's saying that we, looking thousands of years later, looking at a text and saying, well, here's the possible meanings. This one seems most probable given the context, but we can sort of make one or two or three other meanings. We can sort of make them work. It's just that we feel it doesn't fit the context as well. Okay?
Right.
In cases like that, sometimes you just don't have enough information about the ancient context. But often you do, and you're into that situation saying, this is most probable. Well, the native speaker doesn't go through the same process psychologically as we do now. Hmm. Rather, he immediately knows what the meaning is, because it's so fast that the whole thing is unconscious.
Right.
So I illustrate it sometimes of sort of a, if I look out the window and say, winter is here, you know, because it's so cold or because the trees, branches are bare. Mm-hmm. Except that won't work. I use it with the word spring. It's not springtime, so it doesn't work. Say winter has, spring has come. Nobody interprets it as the mechanical spring in a mechanism.
Yes.
Why not? Because it doesn't fit the context.
Yes.
And you do it so fast that you don't even realize that there's potentially another meaning.
Yes.
And if that, so there is a use of a kind of frequency thing, but it's a frequency that's heavily dependent on context. And that's why I've seen people, for instance, with a scientific or engineering background, come into seminary, and some of them get it and some of them do not. And the ones that do not, they expect natural language to behave like the mechanisms that they have studied in engineering, let's say, and it doesn't. It's much more subtle.
I see. They can't take prior distributions as normative priors and then use that to prove, to use Bayes' theorem to kind of run the analysis backwards to prove a likelihood of the hypothesis.
Okay, yeah, you could put it that way, but what I, my point is, there's, you can't even estimate the probabilities in a except in terms of a large quantity of knowledge. And so
you can't estimate the probability of a word use unless you have the same context as the original reader.
Yeah,
I see.
Yeah, and the context is not just, oh, this other vocabulary item occurs, but it's the context of meaning above all. Meaning tends to drive everything else in human communication. So it's kind of like the IBM Watson playing Jeopardy.
Right.
And it, I was rooting for IBM because I'm a techie. You know? but Watson doesn't understand anything.
Right, he doesn't know. He doesn't understand any of the answers he's giving. He's just giving them, right. Right.
So it's just a tour de force, technically, that the machine is able to do as well as it does, because there's so much that is governed by meaning that is part of the whole interpretive process.
Well, I that makes sense to me. Context overwhelms everything. Because books are written to be understood.
Yes.
That's the intent of those writings, is to be understood. And so the cognitive universe of the reader provides the spectrum of meaning. It provides the sort of matrix of meaning possibilities.
Yes.
That's what it's about. I'm talking to you. We both speak English. We're both live in the 21st century. We're both Americans. We have a certain context. I'm talking to you. I speak to you in a certain way. I wouldn't speak to a toddler the way I talk to you. I wouldn't speak to an Arabic friend the way I talk to you, right? I mean, we assume a certain continuum of meaning. We lack that continuum of meaning with the writers of the New Testament. Or at least as much of it.
Yes and no, because they're still human beings.
That's right.
And
we can read them over and over again, and we can read contemporaries, and we can sort of maybe, I'm guessing, maybe 10% enter into their world. You know, so we can't establish priors for probability distributions.
Not in the same way, not as directly, we can understand actually a lot about the ancient context,
right.
But it is a matter of degree, and it's partly that in the case of the Bible, because there's a single divine author, that we use the larger context of the whole of the Bible also to rein in certain things that would be theoretically possible meanings for individual verses. And you say, no, that doesn't fit with what the Bible teaches elsewhere.
Yes, I see. And we have the Septuagint. We have the Old Testament in Greek, Septuagint. So that gives us some word usage. That gives us some continuity between New Testament and Old Testament.
It does.
On the other hand, let's say we approach a passage and we don't have a prior. In other words, we don't have a reason to... We don't know. We simply just don't know. Then why not start with your principle of symmetry and assign a probability of 50%? Or assign an equal probability to each synonym. Maybe I'm
right
into the weeds. You see what I'm driving at?
Well, yeah, except, again, in natural language, words are never complete synonyms. They can be heavily overlapping in meaning,
I
but
see.
There are often subtle reasons why one word is left is used rather than another. So even that, it becomes a problem. But there are instances where you say, well, I just, for instance, with text criticism, you know, where the extant manuscripts have two different words, and sometimes you can say, well, this fits the context of the book and this other does not. Or sometimes you can say, this is many more manuscripts and more reliable manuscripts.
I see.
And so you have a kind of probabilistic, vague probability. You can't give exact numbers, but you have a vague probabilistic reasoning. But sometimes you look at it and say, both are possible. I don't know. But actually, those cases are over and over again, they're cases where it makes very little difference in meaning. That's why you can't tell.
Yeah. I guess what got me started on this, one of the reasons I'm kind of pushing is I'm working on the creation account, working on doing an exegetical paper on the creation account.
Uh-huh.
And I looked at, first word in the Bible, Bereshit, in the beginning. And I did a word search on that, and every other time the word appears in that form, in the Tanakh, it is the beginning of the reign of a king. In other words, there's no usage of Bereshit that is, beginning of a family, beginning of a pilgrimage. Every other time it's used, it is, say, in the beginning of the reign of King such and such, or the beginning of the reign of King such and such. Now, so I look at that and I say, maybe the focus of this is not on the science or the metaphysics. Maybe the focus of this is on a kingdom. But then how do I quantify that? In other words, let's say there's five Hebrew words for beginning. If I don't know anything else, if I don't have any priors, there's a 20% probability that this word would be used if the writer was not trying to specify this set of connotations. So you see what I'm driving at?
I do, but I think there's, in your case, there's an easier way of getting at it, and that is that we, the rest of Genesis, and indeed the Psalms and their reflections back on creation, divine kingship is a big theme.
Right.
And God is the great king, and Adam is actually made a vassal king, a subordinate king.
Yeah, he's the prince.
He's created in the image of God. So the theme is there, but it's not strongly dependent on the fact you have a particular word. Again, it's the context of meaning.
Right.
The king.
Right. Right. And what I'm finding is that the text shows many, many, many indications of that. In other words, that thesis bears itself out in many details of the creation account.
Yeah.
But I don't want to sort of start off with the Psalms. I want to start off with Genesis 1:1 and say, how much do we know there?
Right.
And anyway, so that's, what I hear is a little skepticism about the use of probability and statistical methods as an exegetical tool.
Well, it can easily be abused because their interpretation involves so many factors you can't quantify.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I think of it as one tool set among many, but I don't think there's anyone more qualified to speak on this issue than Vern Poitras, so I'm going to tread lightly if I do an appendix on probability theory. All right. I've enjoyed this a great deal. I feel like I've taken more of your time than you had bargained for. Is there anything that you want to add, anything that you kind of wish I had asked or that you kind of want to get off your chest or something that you think needs to be said that we didn't cover in this conversation?
Well, if I had more time, there would probably be more things. But I think one thing I would wanted to communicate in the book on chance and sovereignty of God is the sense of the beauty of probability theory, of the mathematical side, of its coherence with the world. The sense of being in awe of God rather than, oh, this is just interesting information. that and that fits together with what you've rightly detected in what you call the cosmic personalism, that we're always living in the presence of God, and so seeing God's hand in the world that He's made and the ways He's crafted it, it should lead to praise. And I hope that one of the effects of my book can be that people who thought of a lot of things as, well, they're just there and we just accept them, now they're admiring the wisdom of God.
Math is beautiful because God is beautiful, and math is a part of His mind. And math is worship, the same as as much as singing hymns is worship. It is, it might not be the same kind of worship, but it's also an act of worship.
Yeah, well, we don't worship our own ideas, right? But we worship the divine original, which we've seen God has given us these ideas, yes.
Right, that's right. The doing of math is a form of worship because it's an attempt to think God's thoughts after Him.
Yes.
We're trying to conform to the degree we can into His image. So it's beautiful. So you ever thought about teaching this stuff? Because it seems like in the Christian subculture, it's a literary subculture, but not a mathematical or scientific subculture. And if you're in and out of Christian circles, even intellectual Christian circles, it's largely about philosophy and theology, literature, etc., family life, perhaps. But it is not now. In the past, it has been. I mean, Thomas Bayes was a minister, right? Venn diagrams, that's a minister. George Bull, Boolean algebra. It's ministers, you know, almost over and over again. Eugene Euler, Pascal, really kind of the founder of probability theory, a great theologian. There's a time when Christianity and math were riding together culturally, and now they don't seem to be.
I have taught some of this in Sunday school context and in conference context, and I think people get excited because they haven't seen the connection. But I think there are also limitations because I also, you know, as a person who's teaching prospective ministers, I say if you have a background in science, if you are ministering the Word of God, you don't talk about your science as the focus. It can illustrate it, but the focus is what does God say? You know, so there's the church has to respect the fact we have a central message, and it's for everybody, not just the people that are interested in science. But in addition to that, and yes, we've talked, you know, we've said several times, science and the probability and statistics and all those mathematical things, they have such an influence in the modern world that it is important that even the non-specialists have an insight in a beginning way to understand God has ordained this. And it is a beautiful and wonderful thing if it's not twisted into a false god.
I see. When you say God has ordained this, did God create the law of mathematics, or are the laws of mathematics inherent in His nature?
Yeah. Well, that's tackled more thoroughly in the book on redeeming science, but I see the truths of scientific laws as on the divine side rather than the creature side.
Yes.
They are His specifications. They are His word, and they have divine attributes. So they're not part of this world. They're law governing the world. And that's true in the mathematics, too. Now, the mathematical ideas in our head, they're clearly in us who are creatures, but we are thinking God's thoughts after Him. The original is divine.
So the mathematics is in His mind, but the dice are created.
Yes.
The pure, true mathematics that He thinks is uncreated. It's part of Him. It's who he is. He's one in three. He's three in one. He didn't create the number three. He's always been the number three.
Yeah.
But the individual things in the world that we can count to three with, the dice that we throw or the coins that we flip, those are created.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, very, very interesting. I enjoyed this quite a bit. The book is Chance and the Sovereignty of God. The author is Vern Poitras, who's a professor at Westminster Theological Seminary.